Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Middle East Studies. I'm James Dorsey, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Joanna Lillis about her new book, Dark Shadows, Inside the Secret World of Kazakhstan. Joanna, welcome to the show.
Hi, James, and thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Perhaps we can kick off by you telling us a little bit about yourself, sort of an intellectual biography, how you got into journalism, how you got into Central Asia.
Sure, yeah, I'd be happy to. Well, I'm talking to you today from Kazakhstan. Let's start in the present before we move to the past. I'm in Almaty, the city where I have been based for the last 14 years now. To Kazakhstan, and I got into journalism really through post-Soviet studies, if you like. I studied at university when the Soviet Union still existed, and I chose to study Russian at that time, and it was by that time the late 80s, and I studied Russian at university in the UK, at University of Leeds, Russian and French actually, to a great degree because I liked languages very much, but also because that was such an interesting time, for the Soviet Union. Mikhail Gorbachev had come to power in the mid 80s, and become a great reformer. There were these buzzwords, perestroika and glasnost, which many people have probably forgotten today since it was 30 years ago. But it was all about change. Perestroika was about trying to revamp the Soviet Union's creaking economy, which was obviously one of the things that eventually brought it down. It wasn't very successful. And glasnost was about giving people greater freedom of speech, or certainly to a degree, let's put it that way, allowing some kind of open debates in a country that was really heavily censored and where people were afraid to speak out. And this kind of captured my imagination. I'd never obviously been to the Soviet Union at that time. When I first started learning Russian, I was 16 years old at a college. But it captured my imagination. There was a program on TV, I recall. It was called Tavarishi, which means comrades. It was on the BBC, and it showed these ordinary Russians, and it showed them as people like us. And I guess that was exciting for me because we'd grown up fearing nuclear war and being really afraid of the Soviet Union. Ronald Reagan once called it the evil empire. Actually, seeing this as something real and these people as ordinary people like us was so interesting to me. I studied Russian, and that's what took me to the Soviet Union. I went to the Soviet Union for the first time to study in 1988. I went to what's now Belarus. At that time, it was called Belarusia or the Republic of Belarusia. I went to Minsk to do language courses. And the following year, I went to Ukraine, to Kiev, and studied there for 3 months. And afterwards, just when I finished my studies, the Soviet Union actually collapsed. That was obviously an incredibly momentous historic event. And soon afterwards, I finished, graduated, and I went back to work in Moscow, first as a teacher of English and then later doing different jobs Later, I worked for the British Embassy for a while, not as a diplomat, but as in a job called the Ambassador's Social Secretary, organizing social events. And then I moved into journalism. I got a job in BBC Monitoring. That's a department of the BBC that that monitors media in different languages and from different countries, and provides information translations to other parts of the BBC and to analysts and so on. So that's what took me into journalism. And eventually I moved with BBC Monitoring to Uzbekistan. So that's next door to where I am now. That was 2001, right before the 9/11 attacks, in fact, a couple of weeks before. And those 9/11 attacks made that put Central Asia on the map for a while, because the Americans opened bases in the region. And, you know, Afghanistan was nearby. There was a war began and so on. And I worked at, in Uzbekistan with BBC Monitoring for about 4 years. And when that contract finished, I finally moved to Kazakhstan, where I am now, and began to freelance. And so that's what brought me to the region, rather long-winded answer. But that's what brought me into Central Asia and into journalism.
Well, and it's produced an incredibly insightful, colorful, and accessible portrait of one of the key countries in the region. Perhaps we can start with sort of what the importance is of the creation of Astana, both in terms of a reinvention of a nation, but also in terms of what we recently saw with the renaming of the capital from Astana to Nur Sultan, President Nazarbayev's first name, and what that means for Kazakhstan, its external relations, but also the formation of its, of a Kazakh identity.
Yes, I mean, as you say, the capital, Astana, and now Nur Sultan, has really been in the news this year, because when Nur Sultan Nazarbayev resigned after 30 years at the helm of Kazakhstan in March, the really very first act of his successor, who was who became the interim leader and then the elected leader later, his more or less first act was to propose renaming the capital. And of course, that decision was immediately rubber stamped. And the city that was called Astana, which means capital actually, then became Nur Sultan. And that didn't go down too well with many people in this country. But obviously, talking about the symbolism of that city, that really brought home, you know, just what how symbolic the city is meant to be, how symbolic it is in the mind of Nazarbayev himself, who obviously approved the decision, although he modestly, you know, or acted as if it was someone else's initiative. But it's a really symbolic city in his mind, in the way that he believes, as the founding father of Kazakhstan, he built the nation and he built that city. And it's symbolic in the minds of everybody else too, the way that the new president immediately proposed naming it after the old president. Now, as I mentioned, that didn't go down too well with many people in the city and in the country. And immediately that decision was announced, people began to take to the streets in small numbers. Kazakhstan was certainly at that time not known for protests, but there have been a number of protests ever since that time. But the renaming of the city, of the capital, to Nur Sultan was one of the first acts of protest, one of the first things that happened that sparked acts of protest, which really are still continuing in a very small way, but in a country where people weren't that willing to protest because of the risk of arrest. And the fact that people were willing to take to the streets to express their discontent, their anger with the high-handed decision to rename the capital without their consultation, tells you also just how much it means to people too. So I think it's really Astana. I think anybody who's looked at pictures of it can see it. It obviously is a vanity project. I mean, it's been criticized, and so has Nazarbayev himself, because you know, many people see it as a real vanity project, just writ large across the steppe, a monument to Nazarbayev himself, if you like, just the amount of money that's been spent on it and the way that most of the decisions have been made, you know, at the official level without consultation of the people who live there. But the fact is, it is consciously, the city that's now called Nur Sultan is consciously presented as a nation-building project, as something that is intended to bind the people around the idea of Kazakhstan as an independent nation. It's meant to be a source of pride. And although it's certainly a quirky and unusual city, and in many ways it's not a very livable city, and in the sense of it's extremely cold, it's extremely windy, and many people believe it's rather badly designed. It's not designed with a pedestrian in mind, for example. But it is intended to be a symbol of pride, and in many people, including the people who live there, are proud of Astana, and in fact that's one of the reasons why they were so frustrated at it being renamed without any consultation with them. So yeah, Astana is something, or the city now called Nur Sultan, is really something. If you want to understand Kazakhstan, you have to kind of get your teeth into that. But you have to look beyond the shiny, gold, quirky buildings. The style of architecture is so often criticized as dictator chic. And it really is rather exuberant, and in many ways over-exuberant. But you have to look beyond that to see, in some ways, insecure nation trying to find its feet and trying to create symbols to bind the public around. Of course, as I say, the protests over the renaming that city certainly haven't been welcome, I'm sure, for Nazarbayev and for Kassim Jomart Tokayev, the president who proposed the renaming. I think there was one very symbolic moment when a young woman went walking around Astana, around the city, shortly after the renaming, and she was merely saying in Russian, Nur Sultan is not my capital and Tokayev is not my president. And that was a very symbolic moment of people kind of rejecting, not necessarily Tokayev as president or even the name change, but rejecting the idea that decisions must be made for them all the time from above. They want to be part of it.
I mean, no doubt the renaming of the city as Nur Sultan sort of reinforces the image of a monument to the president, to Nazarbayev. But if I'm not incorrect, when they first conceived of Astana and then went ahead to found it, there were also significant geopolitical reasons in terms of relations with Russia, as well as reasons that have to do with the intercommunal, the demographic balance between various ethnic groups.
Absolutely. I mean, in many ways, you know, it's quite frustrating that over all these years, Astana has always been depicted quite simplistically in much of the international media as this glossy gold vanity project and nothing else, just a monument to egoism of a president. But it is so much more than that. The geopolitical and also domestic considerations that were at play when the capital was moved in the 90s are still at play today, indeed, and that's why they're so important. So I think, there are many reasons have been cited for the move of the capital from Almaty, the city where I now am, in the south of the country, to right up into the north or into the central northern part of the country. And they have included, officially there were reasons were cited such as space, because Almaty is surrounded by mountains, so it's hard for it to expand, and it is a crowded city also. Unofficially we heard, officially we also heard that it's an earthquake zone, that's dangerous for the capital, that's certainly true. But there were other gossip, of course, that it's quite near to the border with China, and that was believed to be a factor. But that's also, in a way, there's a much more important factor that I'll dwell on now, because, you know, I don't think anybody really seriously believed that China was going to storm over the border and sort of invade. So I think one of the real factors, ethnic considerations, and they're sort of trying to get the center of gravity of the country into a more central geographical location, but also moving the capital of Kazakhstan into the sort of more Russian heartlands, the heartlands where the Russian speakers are more located, which is, of course, naturally more in the north and along that long 7,000-kilometer border with Siberia. There were in the 90s there were many cities which had very large Russian majorities, both Almaty and Astana also had very significant Russian majorities. It wasn't called Astana at the time, of course, but there's also many other cities all along that northern stretch that had really large Russian majorities of ethnic Russians, and I think there was a feeling that it would be better to govern the country from that area. And also, it would this is not an official explanation; it's never been stated officially, but it seems very likely that that would also be a sort of way of Kazakhifying some of the areas to make more Kazakhs live there, because there are many Kazakhs involved in government, of course. And so there would be a big move of Kazakhs, and there really has been. There's been a massive shift from the population of that city is now very, very, I forget the figures exactly, but it's firmly Kazakh now. I think that consideration of how to manage what was a large ethnic Russian majority at independence, there really was a lot of consideration given to how to cope with that. Because, of course, Russia is a very large and powerful neighbor, even in a weakened state that it was in the 1990s. It's important to remember, in terms of the way Kazakhstan thinks about itself, the way officials think about it, and also the way people think about it, that at independence, when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, Kazakhstan was the only one of the former 15 republics that made up the Soviet Union, where the people who gave the name to the country, the Kazakhs in this case, were in a minority at independence. Now, they slightly outnumbered Russians, but altogether minorities made up 60% of the population, Kazakhs a little bit less than 40%. This has a big impact on the national psyche, and it had a big impact on all kinds of decision making in the 90s, including where should we locate our capital.
There's the whole issue of demographic balance. In some ways, I mean, there are vast differences too, but in some ways, it reminds me of Singapore, where you have in both countries an emphasis on intercommunal harmony, on a degree of social engineering also to maintain demographic balances, or in the case of Kazakhstan, actually change demographic balances. But what strikes me is one of the major differences with Singapore is Singapore is a society that obviously has been economically and socially very, very successful. And one of those pillars of success is that virtually everybody in Singapore, every Singaporean, irrespective of what his or her attitude is towards the government, feels that he or she has a stake in society in terms of economic well-being, in terms of protection of certain rights. And you have less of that in Kazakhstan, whether it's as a result of corruption, whether it's a result of needing to maintain relations with major neighbors like China, and therefore not standing up for ethnic Kazakhs in the Chinese province of Xinjiang. And so the question is, of course, that in that sense, the intercommunal harmony in Kazakhstan presumably is far more fragile.
Well, I mean, this is a very, very big question. Coming on for 30 years after independence, it's still one of the major preoccupations, I would say, of the government. Kazakhstan has spent the last 30 years trying to promote non-discriminatory policies towards its ethnic minorities, especially perhaps the Russians, who I think there's been even an increased focus on this in the last 5 years, and that's because of the invasion, the annexation, I'm sorry, of Crimea from Ukraine by Russia, and also the outbreak of separatist conflict in the borderlands of Ukraine, pro-Russian separatists. Now, why does that affect Kazakhstan? Well, it's because, Vladimir Putin used allegations of linguistic and other discrimination against Russian speakers as grounds for some of his actions. So Kazakhstan has always been very keen to demonstrate that that it doesn't discriminate against minorities. Now, Russian enjoys a special status in Kazakhstan. It is, of course, the language of many people, the first language of many people, and there is a special protection for it and for it to be used in the public domain. I think that Nazarbayev himself always stressed that he wouldn't tolerate any linguistic discrimination, any discrimination on the grounds of ethnicity. One of the effects of that bending over backwards to accommodate minorities has sometimes been certain Kazakhs maybe feel that not enough has been done to redress the wrongs of the Soviet past. When I think it is fair to say that Kazakhs suffered a fair amount of discrimination. In many ways, the language was under some threat because the speaking of Russian was encouraged so greatly, and many families simply adopted it as their first language and so on. And many Kazakhs feel a lot of resentment about that past and also about historical wrongs done by the Soviets to the Kazakhs, including the man-made famine of the 1930s, in which we still don't know how many people died, but it may be as many as 2 million. So those were Kazakhs. I'm talking only in Kazakhstan, not in other parts of the Soviet Union that were affected by famine, in Russia and Ukraine, for example. So I think the resignation of Nazarbayev has also led to a bit of renewed debate about all this. What is the role of Kazakh, the language? How do you promote Kazakh? How do you get more people speaking Kazakh? And so on. And when it comes to state in society, I think your comparison with Singapore is very interesting. Kazakhstan has tried, sometimes clumsily, but to build a sort of civic identity where people feel like Kazakhstan is what they call Kazakhstan is, meaning that it's not about your ethnicity. It's like, let's say, British or American. It's a common civic identity. And there's been great efforts to promote this, sometimes very clumsily. I think many, minorities in Kazakhstan, they do feel part of Kazakhstan. Most probably feel part of Kazakhstan. And those that don't probably left, for example, because, it's pretty easy for Russians, say, to move to Russia. But when it comes to having a stake in society, I mean, in terms of economic well-being, I think, probably opportunities are as great for minorities as they are for the Kazakhs. But I think when it comes to actual, let's say, political representation or the chances of getting jobs even in the civil service, it's clear that the Kazakhs have the edge there. And that's partly because there's a linguistic requirement for speaking Kazakh, which is obviously quite important. So there should be. But, clearly Kazakh is not taught as well as it should be in schools. And many Russian speakers come out with very little knowledge. And so they feel excluded in many ways from decision making. And when it comes to also having a political stake in society, I mentioned before that, ever since Nazarbayev resigned, there has been a spate of sporadic protests, street protests in Kazakhstan over various issues, including the lack of political voice and others. And I mentioned the renaming of Nur-Sultan. As one of them. But it's very notable to me, just observing the protests in Almaty, for example, that the protests really are led by Kazakhs, and there are very few, if any, minorities usually present as protesters. And I think that might tell us, well, I think this is my personal opinion, but I think it might tell us that you know, people feel that they either don't have enough stake in the political process, or even that they might not be welcome, their views might not be welcome, or that they don't care enough, or they feel that they can't express any opposition, maybe because they don't feel as secure as perhaps the titular majority. So I think it's a really complex question, and it's one that's, you know, going to run and run. I mean, Kazakhs still nowadays make up only coming on to 70% of the population. So there are still minorities, you know, make up a third. So it's something that I think Tokayev, the new president, is going to have to obviously accommodate and work on. And in some ways, I think under Nazarbayev, problems were always brushed under the carpet, and not only when it comes to ethnic relations. It simply wasn't acceptable to accept that there might be anything to debate, that there might be any problems. So it was all brushed under the carpet, and that has led to latent tensions. I mean, I certainly know that there are, you know, many Kazakhs who feel that not enough has been done to redress the wrongs of the past, as I said, and that that inclusive policies have sometimes been at their expense. I'm not saying this is the case. I'm just saying that there is a sentiment out there among some people. And so I think this is something that going forward, Kazakhstan is going to have to keep coping with. And one of the issues, I think, is going to be that question that you mentioned about people having a stake in society. How do you make sure that everybody has a stake in society, especially at the moment when they're trying to head off, the government is trying to head off a protest mood. I'm not saying it's particularly threatening, but in terms of survival or something like that, the government survival, but it is present, and it is Kazakh driven. So the authorities are going to have to cope with that. So I think this is a very important factor that's obviously going to keep being part of all the issues facing Kazakhstan as it enters this post-Nazarbayev era.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You mentioned, of course, the impact of the annexation of Crimea, as well as the pro-Russian insurgencies in two regions of Ukraine, which really represents probably what is perceived as a far greater threat, and that's, you know, Vladimir Putin's, at least to some degree, redefinition of Russia as a civilizational rather than a nation state, and he seemed to emphasize that shortly after the events in Ukraine in 2014, when he denied that Kazakhstan had a history of statehood and was sort of naturally linked to Russia. I presume that really plays into all of this too.
That plays into all of this enormously. So it plays in geopolitically, it plays in terms of how Kazakhstan confronts its identity and the identity of its people and how it promotes civic identity. All of this has been really, I think, really on the government's mind over the last 5 years, basically, or a little more now, since that conflict began in Ukraine. Now, it was a really pivotal moment, I think, when Putin made his remarks about Kazakhstan's short, in his words, statehood. This was a really pivotal moment for the government, and it's probably worth just mentioning the context of that again. So at that time, he made the remarks about 6 months after he'd annexed Ukraine, and while the separatist conflicts were raging, well, they continued to certainly to be present. But at that time, the time when he made his remarks was the time when Russia was perceived, in the region as being really bellicose towards its neighbors. I mean, annexing a piece of land and allegedly fomenting separatist conflict. Now, for Kazakhstan, many at the time, many, for example, Western media drew parallels that Kazakhstan is very similar to Ukraine, and is Kazakhstan the next Ukraine, and so on. And those parallels were based on a long border with the neighbor and also a large Russian-speaking minority. But of course, Kazakhstan always was keen to emphasize the differences, including like non-discriminatory policies that it pursued over all those years. Putin actually made his rather derogatory remarks that he presented as being a compliment to Nazarbayev. Shortly after Nazarbayev had mentioned, really in passing, I don't think he expected there to be a big media furore about this, but he had said that Kazakhstan would withdraw from the Eurasian Economic Union that had just been created, a Russian-led free trade zone that had just been created, if it felt its sovereignty was threatened. Now, as I say, I don't think he expected any media furore, and I don't think he meant that to be a threat to Putin. In fact, he made those remarks at a meeting in Kazakh, and he may have not even expected them to be picked up. Some of the things he said in Kazakh often just are not picked up beyond the Kazakh media. But when those remarks were picked up and then presented as if it sounded like some kind of threat, very soon afterwards, Putin made his remarks in response to what was clearly a planned question at an event in Russia, where a student sort of made some remarks about, mentioning what she perceived as discrimination against Russians in Kazakhstan, based on, with no evidence provided, and then asking the question about whether Kazakhstan might face a Ukrainian-style future after Nazarbayev. Now, that's clearly a threatening kind of a question, and nobody believes that student thought it up herself. It was obviously planted. And Putin then made his remarks that Kazakhstan had a very short statehood, and he presented them as a compliment to Nazarbayev by saying that he built a state in a country that had no experience of it, other than the last 20-odd years. Now, many people in Kazakhstan were absolutely furious with those remarks. They found them insulting by a former colonial power. They found them insulting to Nazarbayev. They found them insulting to Kazakhstan. And after that, we saw a renewed interest in Kazakh history driven at the official level, including celebrations of Kazakhstan's statehood, which is now celebrated, dating back to 1465, when the first Kazakh Khanate was founded. So you can see that events in Ukraine, the annexation of Ukraine, the alleged fomenting of separatist conflict in that neighbour, it has really been a seminal moment for Kazakhstan too. And I think that not only because of witnessing how far Russia is willing to go in its aggression against a neighbour and a former Soviet country, but also in terms of, the duplicity of Vladimir Putin, the boldness in which he pursued his aims, and the rapidity with which it all happened, and the ruthlessness as well, of course, of so many people dying. And I think that was probably a very shocking moment for Nazarbayev, because he himself has always said that Russia is Kazakhstan's biggest ally. Now, of course, China is another big ally. But he's always said that Russia is Kazakhstan's closest ally, and he's always they enjoyed a reasonably warm relationship with Vladimir Putin. So the sight of a bellicose Russia snatching a bit of a land from a neighbour and fomenting conflict was not a pleasant one for him. I'm sure it was pretty much a wake-up call that maybe maybe Russia isn't as close an ally as you've always thought, or something like that. Of course, Kazakhstan remains a very close ally of Russia, but I do believe that was a big wake-up call for Astana, as it then was, and for Nazarbayev.
It strikes me that you sort of vividly describe the significance of Putin's remarks when you portray sentiments among the Kazakhstan's Cossack and Slavic population groups.
Yes, indeed. Now, I soon after Putin made those remarks, very, very soon after, less than a month, I went, it was before, in fact, but it was after, very soon after the annexation of Crimea, a couple of weeks later, I traveled to northern Kazakhstan to meet, to see how Russian communities felt about what was happening. It seemed to me a very important thing to do. Now, Kazakhstan itself, I mean, in terms of the government, was caught on the geopolitical hop, if you like, and was really struggling to formulate the correct diplomatic response. Russia is an ally, but on the other hand, a post-Soviet country that's smaller than Russia and that is its neighbor doesn't want to endorse the annexation of pieces of land from another one. So that was one factor. But also then Kazakhstan had to also, you know, reconcile, you know, competing opinions within the country, among, say, maybe some of Kazakhs and among Russian speakers who are very much subject, you know, very, very, very susceptible to the bellicose propaganda that was coming out of our Russian TV. Kazakhstan has to also reconcile those elements of the domestic population as well. And so I decided, rather than just asking, you know, Russians in the south of Kazakhstan, where I live, where their population is smaller, to go to their heartlands and to see how people felt there. I met some of the Slavic community leaders. So these are not necessarily typical Russians, because by the nature they're more public figures, and by the nature of leading some of the groups, they're perhaps more political and more maybe more nationalistically inclined too. But I thought it was important to talk to them about how they felt. Now they were very, very they were quite bellicose in their expressions about, say, America, about the West generally as being duplicitous, they were certainly in favour of Russia's position, in favour of the annexation of Crimea, and so on. So that was an eye opener. I also found among ordinary people on the streets that there were very few people who would actually question that, and that most people I spoke to, in fact, all of them, that when I suggested, well, how would you feel if that happened to Kazakhstan? Nobody could even imagine that could happen to Kazakhstan, because they basically more or less bought the Russian TV line that Ukraine had brought it on itself. So in other words, if Kazakhstan didn't do anything wrong there, that wouldn't happen to Kazakhstan. But I think I did find that was the level of support for the Kremlin, the level of support for Russia, and the fact that some people are clearly living with their eyes on over the border rather than, you know, looking towards Kazakhstan, their own country. I think that was a factor. And obviously Russian TV, it has a massive influence on people's mentalities. But I think it did also bring home to me the level of the challenge that Nazarbayev was trying to cope with. The thing that he had on his mind ever since independence, the fact that we've got this very large Russian minority, not so large nowadays, but still nearly 20%. You need to accommodate their feelings, and you also need to be sure not to antagonize Russia. And in 2014, it became very clear what the consequences might be if any country does antagonize Russia. You know, serious consequences, losing territory and having separatist conflict. Fermented. So I think a big wake-up call there, and also another reminder of the scale of the challenge facing Kazakhstan as it tries to reconcile, you know, sometimes competing agendas among its own population, with the Kazakh majority, with the large Russian minority, and of course other minorities too.
The Kazakhstan has had a very actually successful program dating back to shortly after independence of trying to persuade ethnic Kazakhs and the Kazakh diaspora to return to Kazakhstan. And it's been successful. You've had about roughly a million people who have returned. And all of this obviously predates what happened in Ukraine in 2014 and Putin's subsequent remarks. But I wonder whether the significance of that repatriation program has changed or has been enhanced by what the events in 2014.
This program in Kazakhstan, it's called the Voroman program, informally actually. Voroman is returnee, and some people find that ironic, because in many cases, you know, the people, in most cases, in fact, some of the people had never set foot in Kazakhstan before they supposedly returned. But it's considered a return to the hot historical homeland. Let's say that that's the way, the ancestral heartland, whatever, and that's why it's called that. Currently, there's a big debate going on. Actually, the president Tokayev has suggested that the word should be changed to and the word for people should be Kandas, which comes from the word for blood, meaning we're of the same blood. But that's in a way by the by. The fact is that this program has been successful in many ways, as you said. A million Kazakhs have come from all kinds of countries to Kazakhstan over the last nearly 30 years now, and they come from countries near and far. They come from other post-Soviet countries where the lifestyle is similar, for example, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Russia, and they've also come from countries much further afield, such as Iran, also China, and Turkey, for example, Mongolia. So this program has been successful in terms of getting large numbers of Kazakhs to move to Kazakhstan, which has also boosted the ethnic Kazakh population in Kazakhstan. It's also encountered many, many difficulties, and the government is fairly open about a lot of them. It's slowed down a lot in the last few years. You know, the numbers have reduced over the last few years of people coming, and that may be partly related to financial issues too, because they get certain amounts of support, and there have been certain, you know, economic blips over the last few years that have an effect. But there's also been problems of integration that the government acknowledges that I think were very unexpected for many people. For example, Kazakhstan is still, in parts of Kazakhstan are still very Russian speaking, and it can be difficult to get a job unless you speak Russian. Now, I think many of the Kazakhs who, especially in the earlier years, came here, they certainly didn't expect that they came here as fluent Kazakh speakers, and they wouldn't expect to find that integration problem, that linguistic problem. They wouldn't expect to encounter that in Kazakhstan. It was a big shock for many of them. And I think some people who've come from different kinds of backgrounds, and then moved to Kazakhstan, found it very difficult to adapt. And the government has acknowledged much of that. And so, as I say, the program has slowed down. In fact, there was a major change announced to the program in 2014, right around the time of the conflict in Ukraine. The government announced that it would be directing migrants northwards, as a stipulation. If people moved to Kazakhstan, they would have to settle in northern regions and also in one western region. Now, the government presented that as being about where labour is required, you know, where there are labour shortages. But many people believe that was another attempt to sort of, gerrymander, if you like, the sort of population and try and make Russian regions more Kazakh. And for various factors have actually made that happen. I mean, there are very few places now in the north of Kazakhstan where Russians are still in a majority. Not so many places, and not so under. I think only one region left where they're regionally among the majority. All that has had an effect, and people, you know, it was very significant. I think people thought it was significant that those migrants were directed northwards immediately after all the conflict in Ukraine began, and also migrants were directed from the south of Kazakhstan, which is mainly ethnic Kazakh, also directed given perks to move north. So it's clear that there was some I mean, obviously labor shortages were one issue, but there was very much a feeling in Kazakhstan that this was about demographics, the government's attempts to influence demographics and make the north of Kazakhstan more Kazakh. So the program, the program continues, but as I say, it's much, the flow of migrants is much slower now, you know, the integration problems still remain a factor, and there is also resentment among Kazakhstan-born Kazakhs sometimes that they you know, in many countries, there's always fear of migrants, and people feel that they get perks that you know, Kazakhstan-born Kazakhs get. The perks have changed very much over the years. At one point, there was cash perks. I don't think there are anymore, but they can be, you know, anything from access to microcredit and help with housing and jobs and so on. So the program continues, and I think it will always continue. Probably, I can't imagine any president coming along and cancelling it, because it would be very emotionally problematic, I think, for many Kazakhs, even if they don't always support it. But I think it was something that Kazakhstan did. It presented the program as to bring, attract Kazakhs to Kazakhstan, as sort of trying to redress the wrongs of history. You know, for example, you know, many Kazakhs ended up in foreign countries because their families fled famine, they fled to survive, or they may have fled war, revolution, and so on. So that was about putting the wrongs of history right. You know, I think that's still a big factor. And there were still certainly Kazakhs left abroad. I mean, there are still believed to be 1.5 million Kazakhs in China. Now, in Xinjiang, most of them live in Xinjiang, the area that you mentioned. And this is this migration program in Kazakhstan also is involved with this whole current major controversy ongoing in the world about the treatment of ethnic minorities in Xinjiang, about their incarceration in camps that the Chinese government says are vocational training centers, and about general attempts that critics believe are attempts to eradicate their religion and their culture, and to make them part of the mainstream, if you like. So the Waterman program, because you know, people come and go from Kazakhstan, or certainly in the past, come and go from Kazakhstan, and between Kazakhstan and China, and many of these people are these migrants who've moved here or want to move here. This has also had an impact on that, and it also means that Kazakhstan has been a one of the places where much news has come out about the camps from Kazakhstan, because people with experience of them have moved to Kazakhstan and spoken to the media.
Which leads us almost automatically to Kazakh, particularly non-governmental perceptions of China and Chinese ambitions and attitudes towards Kazakhstan.
Yes, indeed, this is very topical right at the moment, because we've seen a sort of series of anti-China protests over recent weeks that have been the primary motivating factor for the protesters has been to protest against what they see as Chinese economic expansion in Kazakhstan. That's been one of the key driver of these protests. But also, you know, at some protests, there have been raised the question of the treat of ethnic Kazakhs along with Uyghurs, Xinjiang's largest, they're much greater in number in Xinjiang and Kazakh, and other minorities. These have also been raised at protests in Kazakhstan. Among ordinary people, there is enormous suspicion of China in Kazakhstan. It was a factor in 2016 in bringing people out onto the streets for the largest protest in probably 25 years in Kazakhstan. Those were protests against land reforms, but one of the driving forces there was the fear that it would be Chinese investors who would come and lease or buy Kazakh land. And that was a driving factor, even though on paper there was, you know, nothing about Chinese investors per se. Now, here we're also seeing the protests that have been taking place in Kazakhstan recently have also been very much about perception. The protests are not particularly large. I mean, they rarely number more than probably not even more than 100 people. But they have been sustained, and they have taken place in various cities, not just in, for example, Almaty, where I am, the largest city, or in Nur Sultan, the capital, but in various cities. In fact, this state of protest began in an oil town called Zhangluzen in the west of Kazakhstan a couple of months ago. So what we see in these protests, we see people just expressing their concerns that China is expanding too greatly into Kazakhstan, and that the concerns are not always based on fact. One of the driving forces in this state of protest has been the idea that Kazakhstan is going to move, that China is going to move obsolete factories to Kazakhstan. And this was based on one comment made by the government a few years ago, that there might be some production facilities brought here, but there have been no programs established, and so people are actually protesting about something that isn't even happening. But the problem is perception, and Kazakhstan is a very a key partner of China on for its Belt and Road initiative to sort of develop global infrastructure with China at the hub. And Kazakhstan, obviously, as a neighbour with a long border with China, is a sort of gateway towards the West, towards Russia and the North and Europe, and then, of course, also towards through the Caspian Sea, towards the Caucasus and Turkey. There are many projects underway in Kazakhstan. The latest tally says there are 55 projects worth around $27 billion. Now, the government says this is much needed investment for Kazakhstan, but the people are very suspicious. They seem to have very heightened suspicion of China in a way that, for example, they don't of their other large neighbor, Russia. There's also an element that the government is poor at communicating, and that there is a lack of transparency in any case over the deals. People are worried about debt traps, but since the terms of the deals are not in the public domain much of the time, they don't have any way of seeing if their worries are valid. And generally speaking, as I say, there's high suspicion of China, of a big neighbour, of a very populous neighbour. And of course, now this is now fueled by the very, very well-known reports of gross and blatant human rights abuses against ethnic Kazakhs and other minorities in Xinjiang have obviously contributed to Sinophobia in Kazakhstan.
Despite the protests and also labor unrest that you've had over the years in Kazakhstan, it seems to me that much of your book sort of sketches a history from since independence of an effort to maintain authoritarian governance structures, a slide into greater repression of basic rights, and also a struggle to come to grips with Stalinist disruption, both of demography as well as Kazakh identity.
Yes, indeed. I mean, those two things you've just mentioned are something I was very focused on and something I very much wanted to explore in Dark Shadows. Let's maybe start with the second one you mentioned, which the struggle to come to grips with the upheavals that Kazakhstan faced in the Soviet Union, and particularly in the Stalinist period, the demographic upheavals that drove Kazakhs into a minority that led to the deaths of so many Kazakhs, and also the the environmental and ecological upheavals, the terrible the tragedies of the Aral Sea that almost shrunk to disappearance and is now being a little bit restored, at least on the Kazakh side, but a terrible environmental and health catastrophe for the people there. And also things like Semipalatinsk, the nuclear testing ground that's still affecting the lives of people who weren't born when it closed up in 91. They are now second, third generation victims. So I wanted to explore all of that because, in fact, partly because much of it remains brushed under the carpet in Kazakhstan itself. People are aware of much of this, but Kazakhstan's always treated this history very, very gingerly for fear of antagonizing Russia as the former colonial master. It's very much treated such things as the famine as a collective tragedy, unlike in Ukraine, where blame is apportioned and it's officially characterized as a genocide led by the Soviets. So I wanted to explore all of that because all of that really shaped particularly that tumultuous Stalin period. It really shaped Kazakhstan today, and Kazakhstan is still grappling with the consequences in terms of demographics, in terms of ethnic relations, in terms of health, in terms of the environment. And the other, as you said, the other thing I explore at some length in Dark Shadows, really in the first part of it, is the first part of it is called actually Making of a Potentate. So that tells you something about the focus of that part of the book. But I wanted to explore that authoritarian element of the way that Nazarbayev really built this state and built it sort of, if you like, in his image or created it partly for himself to rule. I mean, I'm sure he's always believed that he's doing the best for Kazakhstan, and you know, he's a great believer, obviously, in stability. But he's certainly not a great believer listening to dissenting opinions. And I wanted to tell some of the stories of the people who suffered, you know, because of that unwillingness to cater for any kind of dissent. Now, this I think is a really big and important factor now, because what we are seeing with the transition, as soon as Nazarbayev stepped down and as soon as Tokayev stepped into his shoes, you know, we've seen this spate of unusual protests for Kazakhstan, where protesters have over the last, you know, however many years, have been quite reluctant to take to the streets, mostly because they can be arrested, and sometimes they often go to jail for up to 15 days, but sometimes they can be charged with very serious crimes and go to jail for years. So that's one of the reasons that has been a factor that until Nazarbayev's designation, the protests were not that common. Now we're seeing that people are really testing the boundaries of what is now possible in Kazakhstan, because people are, you know, they may have put up with Nazarbayev's, you know, rather authoritarian rule for many years. But now that there is a window of opportunity for change, we're seeing that people want to seize it. And so what lesson should we draw from that? I think we can draw the lesson that for all of the you know, suppression of dissent, which I track very closely in Dark Shadows, I tried to show how the political opposition was wiped out. There were no opposition parties in Kazakhstan, really, to speak of, in legal existence anymore. I tried to show how the media was muzzled, and how also, you know, religion was called into state-sanctioned boundaries, civil society too. So it really wasn't across the board. But now we see that people, despite all of that, there is a very vibrant civil society in Kazakhstan, and people, you know, many people are not willing to put up with authoritarian rule. And, you know, we also see promising shoots. We see Tokayev promising a listening state. We see him promising reform to some degree, for example, on the right to peaceful protest. And we see, as I said, people are pushing the boundaries and saying that they no longer accept, you know, the pact, and they no longer accept authoritarian rule. So this is going to be a very interesting few years for Kazakhstan coming up.
I've jotted down many more questions that I wanted to ask, but I'm afraid that we're nearing the end of this. We could probably chat for at least another hour. But before I let you go, Joanna, tell us where you go from here. In terms of what you plan to do next?
Well, there are lots of interesting opportunities happening, because it's exciting times in Central Asia, really. I think for me personally, and for many people in Kazakhstan, this is a really, really interesting and exciting time. It's a once-in-a-generation time of political change. You know, we just discussed how people are trying to seize that moment to drive change. And so, you know, there are lots of interesting stories to report. Now, because of that, I'm pretty busy with my actual reporting right at the moment. And also because we've got the other, you know, the other big country of Central Asia is Uzbekistan, and that's also going through some really interesting times. 3 years ago, the death of the president, Islam Karimov, the dictator, has brought an unexpected period of reform under the new president, Shavkat Mirziyoyev. And they're 3 years into that reform period now. There's many big changes taking place there, and I'm also busy reporting on those. So even just the actual reporting for me, there's an awful lot on. But I'd still like to, you know, look at other projects, other books, perhaps. I'm actually thinking that Kazakhstan, there's much that would make, you know, interesting fiction. Now, There aren't many people who can make their living writing fiction, but it is something I would like to look into. How could some Kazakhstan's really fascinating history be dramatized in fiction, or how could, you know, some of the modern times too, there have been some pretty dramatic moments that could be could make for some interesting fiction. So anyway, I'm open to all ideas. As I say, currently very busy with reporting on particularly on Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, but also Kyrgyzstan, where there's been the arrest of the former president, a trial about to start. But I think there's probably some interesting projects ahead too.
Joanna, indeed, you live in what the Chinese call interesting times, with lots of options. Thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it and wish you all the best.
And thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.